Hello, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the UI Breakfast Podcast. I'm your host, Jane Portman, and today our special guest is Joe McLeod, a designer, author, speaker, and leader, and we're going to talk about closure experiences or ending experiences.
This episode is brought to you by Tiny Reminder. Tired of nagging people? Build a simple form, set a reminder schedule, and add recipients. We'll keep sending reminders until they submit a response, providing you peace of mind. Sign up free at tinyreminder.com.
Hi, Joe.
Hey, how's it going?
Doing great. Thank you so much for making the time today.
You're welcome. I'm really looking forward to it.
So why don't we start with a blitz questionnaire, and then after five questions, we'll get going with the main topic. Fantastic. Question number one is, what do you do for a living?
Well, I've been working on ENDS and the Closure Experiences project for the last 2 years. And before that, I was running design at Us2, which was a design interaction app product agency in London, Malmo, New York, and Sydney.
Wow, that's very impressive. And how did you choose specifically this niche?
Well, actually, years ago, around 2004, I had a couple of experiences. One which was with a really early voice recognition system on my mobile phone, which was meant to capture voice messages before we were doing a lot of smartphone stuff, and it promised this very brilliant future of sort of being this admin assistant, and it was awful. And the only experience I used to have with it was asking it to play my messages, and it would say, "Oh, sorry, I don't understand you. Sorry, I don't understand you." And it would do this a number of times, and it would be so tiring. And I got so frustrated with it. I didn't want to just end the relationship. I wanted to really throttle it to death and have a sort of emotional, satisfying ending to this awful experience, which obviously I didn't get because no one designs endings. And then also around the similar sort of time, I was teaching at St. Martin's, a design school in London, and I set this project, which is sort of a cliche project around waste and rubbish in the world, and all the students go off and then do the project and come back with more stuff. And it sort of made me think around that time, we really haven't got a vocabulary for endings and offboarding. So ever since, I've been sort of playing with this in the background while I've been getting on with my career and working at all sorts of different places. And the last 2 years, I left my job and decided to focus on this entirely.
Wonderful. What does your typical day look like?
At the moment, in the last couple of years, it's been researching, reading, capturing notes, capturing references, writing, learning to write, which has been an enormous learning curve, and then building the book up, packaging that up, writing it. And more recently, though, now the book's out, it's doing conferences, organising travel, doing lots of stuff on social, like telling everyone where I am, what I'm doing, what the book's doing, how to get hold of the book. So that's my days at the moment.
Typical.
I'm on the internet all day, like on Facebook, on LinkedIn and Twitter. It's actually not as satisfying as it sounds.
What do you enjoy the most and the least about your work?
I do find it frustrating doing so much stuff on social. It makes me think how tough a job it is doing that for a living, because not only is it incredibly distracting, it's quite emotive as well, and not in a good way. And you see a lot of opinion and rhetoric on these platforms. And it's not entirely satisfying. The nicest bit of the job is sharing it in a talk or on a podcast, and then sort of having a discussion with people about it, like I am now with you. I really enjoy talking about it.
That's good to hear.
And sharing its ideas. Yeah.
So these parts, your lifestyle is a typical lifestyle of an author, everything included.
Yeah, I guess, and it's not envious to be an author, I don't think, after now becoming one. Although I do now, I value the craft of it a lot more. I learned a lot in doing the exercise, just in writing a book. And it wasn't like I've always wanted to write a book. It was because it's such a fascinating, compelling story. I had to share it in some other form than a Medium post, for example.
What is your next big thing?
Well, I love talking about this, and I'm passionate about this, so I'm pushing it out there, evangelizing it, building the discussion around endings. I've been doing workshops, so the current book is very much a background and a philosophy. It lays down some themes around, I think, a sort of a new genre of design, as it were. And I feel like it's very much an opportunity to have further discussion. So right now I'm doing a lot more practical stuff. So I'm doing workshops, teaching it, sharing it with people on a practical basis, how they can improve their endings in their products and services. And then I might write another book, which is a lot more of a practical level around it.
Great. Now let's talk about the subject. The way I came across your profile was by catching a glance of your book's cover, which has a striking design, in my opinion. And then I was wondering, like, whoa, this is impressive. What is behind that book? And then I came across you as the author, and I decided you should absolutely be a guest here. So compliments to your cover design as well as the topic.
Thank you. I didn't do it, actually. A very good friend of mine done it, Alvaro. You can look him up if you go back through Twitter, and we in the early days of looking into the cover, we were posting bits of it. He's now in Japan. He's got his own design business now.
Oh, interesting. So as you mentioned, everybody is crazy about onboarding users and guests and everything. So the starting experience is getting more and more attention, while the ending experiences don't. So what would be the right approach should we decide to focus on it? How do we explore the endings?
Well, I think a good place to start is narratives, human-made narratives. So if you think of books or films or games, we create a narrative that is considering a beginning, middle, and end. The ends are often think. So on occasions, the ending of these things are sometimes thought about before the beginning's been really fleshed out. So we're very good at creating narratives in that regard. And narratives do teach us a lot about morals. So when you're looking into narratives and thinking about what they do for humans, it's ever such a lot. We create a sort of a moral compass around the stories we tell ourselves. In fact, a good couple of quotes I'll do here is one's by Elizabeth MacArthur, who's a writer, and she wrote a book about extravagant narratives. So she's a sort of academic critique around narratives. So she says, closure in narratives attempts to preserve the moral and social order, which would be threatened by endlessly earring narratives. Meaning the narratives that have no structure and haven't been considered in that sense are a real mess, and they disrupt that moral order. And another author, Richard Newport, in his book, The End, Narration, Closure, and Film, he talks about closure, solid closure in conventional narratives and histories satisfies individual social desire for moral authority, a purposeful interpretation of life and genuine stability. Now, when we think about narratives that we create as humans and how important they are to give a sense of purpose and moral authority, and then we look at the damage that we do in our in our consumer experiences because we don't have narratives which end coherently, emotionally, and with the moral, with a sort of a moral justice. I think it says that we're very much disrupting ourselves in consumerism. And we can see it all around us in terms of the damage that we do, whether it be our inability to stop the consumption of oil, our inability to have justice around mis-selling in financial products, whether that be the subprime mortgage thing in the US or the PPI products in the UK, which is just in the UK alone, PPI, which is a payment protection insurance for mortgages, 24 billion the banks have been fined for that mis-selling. And if we look at the sort of anxiety levels in social networks, and especially in young women, it's really spiking because of the sort of one-sidedness we have with digital, where we're encouraged all the time to create content, share content, share content. Yet we fail to add in controls to unshare that content, to balance it with deletes and endings. So this sort of stuff's out there forever, and you get judged a lot when you're younger by the sort of silly things we've all done in our youth, but to capture them forever without any ability in ending them is very undermining, I think, to certain age groups.
Absolutely. As for myself, I think I was, I grew up when computers, especially social networks, were not very widely spread. And I'm really happy I did, because I would be really unnerved to have, you know, Facebook and Twitter and everything capturing my, not so crazy, but yet, you know, maybe sometimes confusing deeds of youth.
Well, exactly. And thankfully, there is behavior changes that are happening in those groups. So if you look at the changes in behavior in on Facebook, for example, where people are moving from a model which was broadcast to everyone, hundreds of people, in a very flat way, you know, my dinner, my cat, etc. So and although these numbers are a little bit old, so Facebook sharing fell 5.5% a few years ago. But behind that, personal sharing fell 21%. So sharing, when you're sharing your dinner or your cat, that's personal sharing, not a news item and just resharing it. But at the same time, these sort of WhatsApp, Facebook Messenger, Snapchat all started to grow and have continued to grow consistently. They're doing like 25% year on year. And a lot of this is down to the control we have in that sharing. We have a more channeled, direct sharing mechanism, and something we can control a lot better.
Mm-hmm. So, well, you're saying that the model of publication is flawed by definition because there is no way to pull your content back, right?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And how can we possibly fix that? Let's imagine we are designing a new publishing platform and we want to design it with a closure experience in mind. How would we go about it?
Well, let's look at some of the, before we get into the details of how to do that, I just wanted to share with you one of the saddest sort of situations is revenge porn that we see. Revenge porn is a good example because these are a lot of the content's created by people in privacy with boyfriends, girlfriends, etc. And they, because we haven't got the mechanisms, an ending button or a delete button or a closure button, the individuals lost ownership of that in an interface state. So when revenge porn has been coming out, then people take it to court and try and get it removed. They've had to use things like old hacking laws or old copyright laws, because the content was originally taken on that individual's phone. They used the copyright laws to it. This seems ridiculous that we have to go to this extent to, in essence, remove something you placed there. You've lost control of it. You lost ownership of it. And I'd argue it's because we haven't got a culture of creating endings to the content that we create. We don't allow the user to have an offboarding thing or have the have an ownership of all of the content they create. in terms of what we do in that situation. So
that is such a striking example. Yeah.
Yeah. So having opportunities to share, if you've got a service that you have created a share button on, then you have to create the balance of that with an unshare button. And that should be equally powerful at removing what you've created. But we don't do this leveling of button power, as it were, or share power. It's always this bias thing. You've got this one-way cul-de-sac of sharing.
It's interesting. When I was initially thinking about our conversation, I thought we will primarily talk about experiences for maybe software or how businesses can close up shop. But here you're dealing with such a problem that I almost think is impossible to do, because definitely not everybody in the world will think about it anyways, the unshare button, because they don't care about it.
Yeah, I think we've got a culture, and this is part of the my logic in writing a book about the history of it first, instead of doing the practical application, because this goes way back in history. So we've built a culture which has been established through hundreds of years, really, of having a belief in. We used to have a very rich vocabulary about offboarding and death and life. And we had a clear destination in many religions around heaven as this sort of reward. And many people really wanted to get to heaven because life was brutally hard and horrible. So many of your many religious experiences of heaven were always about abundance, warmth, people who were nice, and comfort. And as we've developed and we've created more and more comfort on earth, and we've created more and more ability to control death, as it were, we've also distanced ourselves from a vocabulary around endings. Now, especially in the Protestant religion, as though the Protestant religion rose up in Northern Europe, they created some different approaches to things, one of which was fasting. Now, in many other religions, we have organized fasting. So you'd have a day or a week or some sort of period where you would withdraw yourself from consumption, and you had a period of abstinence. That was actually not so much, it was a skill that we lost in the Protestant religion. And another component of that was the way we had a relationship with jobs, where in the Catholic religion, which in Europe was the dominant religion at the time, the jobs, the good jobs, were a pope, a priest, or a nun. And those were in the eyes of God, those were good jobs. But in the Protestant religion, they believed that anyone doing good quality work had a belief in their work, had a good job in the eyes of God. Even down to people who were investors had a good, that was considered good in the Protestant religion. Some of these are some of the aspects from Max Weber's work on the Protestant uprising. And then, so let's say, for example, if you are an investor in a business, you would then start making more money. And then with that increased money, you'd start to pay your employees more money. Now, the employees, with the Industrial Revolution coming along, they sort of started to have these decisions about, shall I work less time or shall I buy more stuff? But with the Industrial Revolution providing so much more stuff, and at reduced prices, it sort of starts to become more and more desirable to buy more stuff. So people started to work, and we end up in this sort of wheel of working more in the belief of your job and opportunities to buy more stuff. And at the same time, we're pushing back on death through improved science and medicine. And our personal relationships with death, because we used to look after our dying family and we'd have very clear experiences around the deathbed of our loved ones, which would be quite meaningful, but those were removed. And as we become more and more obsessed with consumption and wealth, and we start to create this environment which allows us to consume this heaven-like abundance on earth without any relationship to endings. So we've got into this mode of endless beginnings almost.
Because that's what shopping is essentially, right? Is
exactly. And you can almost remove the religious components from the Protestant belief structure. Once you remove those, it becomes actually a very interesting model for consumption and the consumer mindset, a consumer religion.
You're just raising more and more problems in a very, very philosophical way. But how can we fix that? I'm all ears. How can we start thinking about that?
So the first thing we need to do is think about it more. Because every time I talk to people about it, it's a matter of I never really thought about it. So we do need to think about it more. And from that will come a lot more ideas around it. We also need to talk about it more with colleagues at work. And that's no small task, really, because once you start thinking about it, you get to understand it a bit more. But we have such a sort of cultural repulsion about endings that it's almost intolerable to talk about such a thing in a business culture. So much of our business culture is about endless growth, which is unsustainable, really. And as we know more recently in the consumption we're doing and the damage to the environment, the type of problems we're having in services and also the emerging problems we're having with digital. Another component of it, I believe, is being able to think about the onboarding and offboarding as a balance. So we were talking about narratives earlier. And if you look at very sort of simple narrative structures as a direct comparison to a consumer journey, you can start to see how advertising marketing directs you, as you might do in a narrative, as you get introduced to a film and the environment of a film and the setting and the actors and the problems that the film's revealing. You sort of can do that in a consumer experience as well. Equally, as the film gets or the narrative gets wrapped up, you can also offboard that viewer of the film, but we can also offboard the consumer experience. So if you start balancing those two, you get a long way in doing it. You can audit what you've currently got as well. So if you just ask yourself, do you have a conscious ending to your service or product relationship beyond the legal expectation, then very many of us don't have anything like it.
While essentially we are leaving a very important opportunity on the table, we can absolutely delight users instead of leaving it sort of hanging in the air.
Exactly. And one thing I often have to get over to people is that, do you believe that your consumers are going to be with you forever? And when you start putting it like that, you start to think, well, they're probably not. And at these points, I often say, like, my marriage is going to end in divorce or death. And I don't think anyone is going to deny that. Those are my only two options out of my marriage, neither of which I want. But I'm in no illusion to think that it's going to end. So why do we not think that our consumer experiences are going to end? Why do we approach them like they're endless?
How could a producer of physical goods, I mean, there is definitely a way to design an UX, the experience of, ending an account in a software product, for example. That one you can think of. How would you approach that of a physical product? Should the producer think of a way to retract their products, try to, provide a thoughtful experience for anyone who buys their stuff?
Oh, absolutely. So a good example is e-waste. So if you look on any packaging for a consumer electronic product, there's a little wheelie bin on the back of it with a big thick line under the bottom. That is the only thing that talks about the consequences of this thing in the environment, the long-term consequences. It's called, it looks like don't throw it away, but as you and your listeners all know, you can't make a button out of a negative. Buttons are always positive things. You can't say, don't do this as a button, because that's impossible to not press it. It wouldn't be anything, would it? So that's pointless to share that with a consumer as have a wheelie bin with a cross through it. But what it does say, it's the WEEE directive symbol, which is the symbol from the European Union. It says you're not, as a producer, an importer or reseller, you have to allow consumers to bring back any electronic product into the store and put it back into the environment. So a good example is I had a 10-year-old Epson printer. And I went back into PC World in the UK, went up to the counter and the information counter and said, I'm bringing this back under the WEEE directive. And they're like, oh, okay, thanks, and just took it away. And I was expecting them to say, "What is that?" So there's almost a conspiracy that consumers haven't got a clue how to offboard the product. And so let's just wrap up that thing. So when you get a new phone, you'll be transferring your data or something like that, and there'll be a point where you have two phones in your hand. And at that point, there's an opportunity for the new phone to acknowledge that there's an old phone in existence. You're probably moving from one device to another. But it isn't acknowledged. And what you do is take your old phone and then you think to yourself, I don't know what to do with that. It's complicated electronics. I can't chuck it in the landfill. I don't know how to recycle it. So what you do is open your desk drawer and you put it in there with the other five generations of phones you don't know what to do with. And so there's lots of components around in physical devices, not just electronic devices, where we have opportunities to acknowledge that this is probably replacing an older thing. Now, what do we do with the data of that older thing? What do we do with the physicality of that? There is loads of opportunities we just could acknowledge in a very small way, and that would help us as consumers reflect on our consumption and take more responsibility about it.
That's amazing. You've just rationalized my delight that I get when I find a graceful way to do away with my old clothes, my old, you know, gadgets, anything like that. I just have delight when I find a useful way to get rid of it. And how wonderful that would be if the producer, the manufacturer would have thought about it.
And have you read Marie Kondo's book of tidying?
Oh, it is one of my favorite books.
Yeah, so it's a really good example in there of offboarding consumer products. And I think you probably know it, but I'll just reflect on it for your listeners. She asks everyone to pick up the things that they're going to dispose of and thank them and acknowledge what they gave to that person. So if it's a pair of shoes, it's like, thank you for allowing me to walk more comfortably. We're going to say goodbye now, and I appreciate your work. And then you put it into the recycling thing. And you can do that with everything, but it's just not a cultural thing we do. Although in Shinto and Buddhism, there is a bit more of that, but generally in the consumer sort of religion, we don't do that type of thing.
And there is one more clause to it that that never came to mind until I read the book, which is, if there is a pair of shoes that I've never got to wear, even if they're sitting brand new but never worn, and what shall I do with them? And the answer is, I should also thank them for teaching me how to make the right decisions about my, you know, clothing style, for teaching me what not to buy. That is amazing.
I love that bit as well. It's such a good book, and it does teach you so much about consumption when we clutter our houses. She's a declutterer, isn't she? That's what she calls herself. And it's a lovely phrase. I think it's really worth... I definitely recommend adjacent reading. If you're interested in ends, read Marie Kondo's book of tidying. It's very revealing.
So our listeners are primarily in the software field, and I would love to get your opinion on two objects to end. One is the individual account of a software user, and the other is the entire business, the entire product. Let's say you start up, you create a startup or bootstrap product, and 1 year later, you decide that it's not, you know, cutting the line in terms of revenue. How do you end that instead of, you know, selling it out? So two of these things, yeah.
I think if it's a timed-based ending, so there's different types of endings you can have, but if it's a timed-based ending, let's say software subscription for 1 month or something, I think it's worth not just pushing people into repurchase, but ask them to reflect on what they've gained out of the usage of that product. So create an emotional ending that makes them think like, oh, I really enjoyed it then, and I thought this was very useful. Even reflecting on particular points which have been busy in the software's usage over that year, for example. And then you can start to tail off into that and offer opportunities, including rebirth into another year of usage, which I think will come up, but also allow them to have a offboarding option, one which ends it appropriately and also reflects on the benefits that they've had out of it.
Mm-hmm. And even if it's even if it is renewed automatically, you can still include self-reflection points in your copy, right? Somewhere yeah, although those the emails the, that you send.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that sort of automatic renewal is a difficult one, because in essence, you're not exposing. You're assuming it's going to go on forever. When does the automatic renewal end? Do we assume that goes on forever? Or is the automatic renewal something that allows them to reflect on the moments they've had with that software, and they should sort of get out of it at some point?
Just like with marriages, I guess the exit of an automatically renewed subscription is an expired card, or the experience of being ended manually, which is a similarity to divorce.
Yeah, and I think that's a good example, because those expiry dates do come up. There's a reality to that, and there's a reality for all of us to experience not using something in the future. So you've got to really map those things. So a couple of things I do to ask these things, especially in something like digital. If you question, I call it the 5x5 rule. If you think about the future of your product or service, now think about it 5 years out. So there's a usage period of 5 years out. What's that landscape? What's that environment look like at that point? Is it, because if you start thinking at 5 years out, you've got to start thinking of endings, haven't you? You've got to start thinking of what is that landscape? How has it ended? And then I ask, add 5% of your project time into your project to think about 5 years out. So the five years out, 5% of your project time. You then start to have to look at endings as a place to add more coherence in your design and your offering.
That's wonderful insight. So I guess the recipe number one when it comes to ending experience is just to dedicate some time to think and deal with that, right?
Yeah, and then I do say, so I've got a few things that I offer people. There's another component which I say, when you're going to design it, this is my phrasing to how you design a good ending. It is connected to the beginning of the experience, so they should be balanced. Think of the internet buttons, share and unshare. They should be connected to the beginning experience. They should be emotional. So many of our narrative experiences are emotional, moral reflections of what we got out of things. It should be actionable by the user so they can acknowledge it happening. So again, like you reflect, like this has happened, you've achieved this, etc., etc. And it should be done in a timely manner, not sort of linger on for longer than 5 years, for example, or done appropriately when the service is obviously finishing. So those are my things. It should be consciously connected to the rest of experience through emotional triggers that are actionable by the user in a timely manner.
So when we talk about the software business that has thousands of users and suddenly they decide to go out of the business, and that happens more often than not because, I don't know, 5% of startups are successful. The rest of them have to deal with a graceful ending. What would be your recommendations to finishing up that experience for thousands of users at the same time?
So here's a good example. The startup community, we talk about fail fast a lot in digital. And actually, there's a lot of celebration of that. But really, that is only a celebration for the founder and that team. If you're talking about people who've supported that team by signing up to a product or service that they've developed, then you're talking about potentially thousands, if not tens of thousands, of people who've given their personal information, shared a load of data with them, and have probably put a lot of emotional effort into a system or a platform that they believed in. And then it's either been bought out, sold out, or failed. So that leaves a lot of people unable to sort of like exit gracefully. Some of those founders send letters out, and a good place to go and look at founders' exit letters is We've Had a Wonderful Journey, the blog, which is by Phil Guyford. He's just captured a load of startup exit letters. And they say things like, we've had a wonderful journey. That's why it's called Wonderful Journey. And they celebrate their own success with a bit of a pat on the back. But then their informational sort of acknowledgement to how the consumer can end the relationship with the service is atrocious. It usually ends in like, oh, and you can get, if you write to support@blahblahblah.com, then we can help you get your data back. Atrocious endings, unemotional and unappreciative almost.
What are the alternatives to that?
Well, I think some of these things come up quite quickly. So sending an email out, the things that change quite quickly, you know, getting an email and saying this is coming to an end, it is very frustrating that it's considered so easy to do that. But one of the biggest improvements will be just good quality offboarding. When you do end up in that situation as a founder, you should be providing coherent opportunities to give actionable emotional endings, which people can capture, download, and offboard coherently, not just with a flippant support email or just shut down your service, assuming everyone's pleased with that. And you also need to do something with that data, like give it back to them, tell them you're going to delete it securely, and communicate how that offboarding is going to happen.
So for the individual account, how would you briefly recommend to provide that ending experience? I guess the export would be a great recommendation.
Yeah, so if you've given, let's say, a great amount of emotional effort and put a lot of work into your personal account with a particular service or platform, then you want to be appreciative of that and reflect about the benefits that they've got. And let's face it, everyone needs to finish these accounts. There's lots of examples of companies not allowing that to happen. But for example, if you left a country, then quite often people shut down accounts. So you need to get them to reflect on what they've done and the benefits that they've had out of that business and that service. And then you need to think about, what does that mean? And some practical examples of that, the benefits. It needs to be emotional. So talk about their personal experience of it. But also it needs to be actionable. So give them an acknowledgement of something that they need to do to sort of shut it down. So make it clear that you're going through those processes and shutting it down, and bring those to the forefront. And also do it in a timely manner. And I think giving them feedback about what stage they're in through this process, and acknowledge at the end of that process that it's done, is good practice.
Great. Joe, I think we can probably keep going about that, but we need to wrap up today's episode. Thank you so much for sharing your wisdom. And where can people find your awesome work online?
So the book's on Amazon. You can buy the paperback there. And you can also get the ebook on lots of different platforms, so Smashwords, Amazon, iBooks, Barnes and Noble, etc., etc. And I'm going to give your listeners, I'd like to give your listeners a free copy of the first chapter, sort of an introductory copy, and then see how they got on with that and see what they think of that. It'd be brilliant. And I'll put something up online, and maybe if you could share that with your audience.
Yes, I will absolutely put the link up in the show notes, so please look up there. And what is your website? Are you on Twitter? Any other digital contacts?
Yeah, I'm on Twitter as Mr. McLeod, and you can also post examples of closure experiences up on Closure Experiences, which is at Closure EXP. And I'm on LinkedIn, and you can find me on Facebook. And the website is closureexperiences.com. And there you can get all sorts of tools. There's a blog on there, and you can get links to the books, etc., etc.
Great. Thank you so much once again, and I hope you have a great day.
Thank you very much, Jane, and thanks for listening.
If you enjoyed listening to this episode, please leave a review on iTunes. It will help other people discover this podcast.